Welcome to Sprouts, radio from the grassroots, a weekly program showcasing radio productions from this and many other independent community stations across the country. We bring local stories to a national audience from a different location every week. I'm Dori Smith of Talk Nation Radio, produced in Storrs, Connecticut.
Time and time again, it's always the same story. When they lose control of nuclear reactors, the first thing that they look to do is control the information.
Today on Sprouts, Yuki Mikami and Tony Boyes join us from Japan to talk about what it's like to live in close proximity to the leaking Fukushima Daiichi plant. The two have become increasingly active in the growing anti-nuclear movement in post-Fukushima meltdown Japan. Their inspiration in part, U.S. activists. Then Paul Guntner of Beyond Nuclear in Maryland joins us to talk about a new battle shaping up over America's aging nuclear power plants, including Millstone in Connecticut.
Hiroshima, Nagasaki, Fukushima, when, oh, when will Mother Earth be free? Will Mother Earth be free? Chernobyl, Nevada, Carolina too, all suffering from the radiation blue.
It's not your father's Chernobyl. That's the headline for an article featured at MarketWatch April 13th. The intent, to calm the nerves of investors by claiming things are not so bad. But scientists around the globe were insisting that Japan should raise the threat level to a Category 7, like Chernobyl, weeks ago, as they studied reports on radiation fallout from Japan. A Geiger counter at a dairy farm featured in a Reuters report April 13th showed radioactive particles arriving at a level of 0.41 microsieverts per hour. The farm is about 50 kilometers from the crippled nuclear plant in Fukushima Prefecture in northern Japan. Even as we were reading that report, news was arriving of several more earthquakes in the same region, one of them registering around 5.8, located in East Fukushima, another 5.0 aftershock in Ibaraki, and a 3.0 in Tokyo. The Japanese government continues to say that there's nothing to worry about. They claim the plant is now stabilized. But Tony Boyes, who lives about 120 kilometers south of the leaking plant, says he's not been kept well informed about the threat.
The problem with the radiation is that you can't see it, and we're not really very well informed about exactly how much it is, although I appreciate that the government, of course, has a very difficult job in testing every locality and then getting people to know how much radiation it is and so on. We were told, actually, just earlier this evening by the local government, every house here, by the way, because this is a rural area, every house has a landline built into the house, and it has a speaker on it, so we get direct kind of broadcasts from the local city office. And what they told us today was that the soil in the rice fields where we're supposed to be planting our rice in about a month's time was much, much lower than the level at which they would have to stop us from planting rice. So in a sense, that's quite pleasant information and quite gratifying. But the fact that there is some radiation there, of course, really leads to a certain amount of anxiety.
And his confusion is understandable. On NHK Japan TV yesterday, a government health official was filmed eating a piece of fruit that was grown near the damaged reactor. But Tokyo Electric Power, TEPCO, has also just admitted that they're still working on a blueprint to stop the radiation leak and cool their reactors and fuel rod storage pools. These same officials keep telling the world that the leak represents just 1/10 of radiation leaked at Chernobyl, or 1% of the total radiation contained at the plant site. Just last week, there was news of radiation levels up to 10 million times the so-called safe limits in seawater off Japan's coast near the plant. After reading about his own country and reports written in America, Tony Boyes became active with the Citizens Nuclear Information Center online. His background as a food and energy researcher gave him an edge, and he blogs at candobetter.net. We asked him to describe the climate in Japan, where more than 17,000 people have turned out for protests against nuclear power.
Well, the Japanese anti-nuclear movement is really minuscule. It's very, very small. And I was very surprised that more than 17,000 people turned out for a demonstration the other day. Up until now, I think if they've had a meeting or a demonstration, it's very unusual to see more than 50 to 100 people turn up. Usually they wouldn't get 100 people turning up. Activism and demonstrations are just not very popular in Japan. It's not a thing that ordinary people get involved in. Activism and especially this anti-nuclear activism against nuclear power stations is very, very difficult. It's very much an uphill struggle.
Tony Boyes told us that whether or not he leaves Japan and brings his family to safety depends on what happens next. And that depends on what he hears from media.
I don't know what's going to happen. It's like everybody else who's caught up in this disaster. We're living from day to day, and we certainly don't know what the next few weeks are coming. It's very, very difficult to look beyond about a month or so in the future.
Ever since March 11th and the major earthquake and tsunami that damaged core containment at the Fukushima nuclear plant in Japan, a radioactive plume has been drifting from Japan by air toward America. It hit California, Washington State, and Oregon within weeks, making its way south to Little Rock and east to Vermont, Massachusetts, and Pennsylvania. Levels have been tested as high as 3 times higher than the EPA's maximum containment level for iodine-131 in water. Radioactive particles also turning up in milk in the U.S., and Japanese officials have been finding continued high levels of radiation in their milk, as well as in seawater, fish, and other crops grown near the plant. We asked Tony Boyes if he had heard about the radiation making its way to New England.
On the East Coast?
That's right.
I can't believe that. Wow, I didn't really think it was that bad. Excuse my ignorance, but living within 120 kilometers of this disaster, I'm really surprised to know that you're getting iodine-131, for example, turning up on the East Coast. That's really a surprise, because this really does make this a world-scale disaster. Japan now imports 60% of its food on a calorie basis. It will probably have to import more now because of this radiation problem. What is going to happen in the future when oil becomes expensive and it becomes difficult for Japan to import food? This is a very, very difficult problem. And yet now we're looking at a situation where we've got a tsunami disaster, earthquake disaster, nuclear disaster happening here, which is going to cost trillions of yen. And I think that Japan is looking at a very, very seriously bad scenario for, what, the next 5 to 10 years, and maybe even after that.
We also spoke with independent documentary filmmaker Yuki Mikami in Japan. He says his work with non-governmental organizations interested in the environment led him to believe in the power of international citizens' movements. He's recently been on location east of Russia to film a nearly extinct tiger in the primordial forest. He too reached out to Americans online, talking with staff at the Citizens Nuclear Information Center and other groups. His environmental consciousness, he says, was raised on March 11th. He's now angry over the lack of accurate information about the radiation leak from Fukushima plant.
Many of us are angry. I think at first we were, well, I was at least, kind of paranoid and worried, because this is the first time virtually that I'm confronting the fear of radiation. But on the contrary, the government and the electrical company, they weren't very clear about what was happening. The very first week after the disaster, I think we were sort of cut off from the information quite a lot. We had this impression of those people, government people and people in the companies in front of the TV, they were not saying everything. I don't think they were lying about it, but I thought they were clearly sort of hiding something. Especially these guys from TEPCO, the Tokyo Electrical Companies, they were like pale, dry-mouthed, and I think eyes were empty. So we worried so much. that's a kind of part of the reason that quite a lot of people were paranoid, including overseas people. And now that people are quite angry, and that's why we go on the streets and do the rallies and stuff, I think, every weekend.
Throughout Europe, there have been challenges to nuclear power, and in Germany, the Green Party specifically going after the Angela Merkel administration, changing their policy, in fact. On a global basis, we're seeing reviews of aging nuclear plants. We asked Yuki Mikami if he thought Japanese officials might also succumb to pressure to convert their energy systems away from nuclear.
Well, we are hoping so. That's why we are working at the moment. And I would like to have this international solidarity of this Green Party, or like green thinking, obviously, starting with Japan, because Japan was hit by disaster and at the same time this critical nuclear power plant accident. So quite a lot of people in Japan are awake now. And I think we have to spread this kind of global network, I think, against this global corporation. I think this is the kind of chance to get into a kind of new type of thinking and doing things. That's what I'm hoping for at the moment. We would like to push towards the company. We would take whole responsibility, and the government would take a whole responsibility of what happened and compensate the people who suffered a lot from this accident. That's what we're hoping for. But there will be a lot of struggles, I think, and we'll be kind of a long way. I think some people have to take things to the courts, and there will be a kind of long fight against the establishment and nuclear power industry. But I think this international solidarity is really important. I think this networks of people around the world can actually change that what's happening at the moment, I think, around the world. Because this nuclear power thing doesn't really happen in Japan only. It's about a kind of global thing.
Now, we've also seen a history of problems with Japan's nuclear industry, something the world has really heard little about, shutdowns, power failures during previous crises. Are you familiar enough with this history to tell us about it?
Ashamedly, actually, I wasn't really aware of the kind of other incidents so much happened in the past, because I think partly we weren't really told about what happened, or I wasn't really conscious about the danger of the thing, because we were told that it was a very small accident, and we didn't really hear about it for a long time. It was like ended in that week, and we weren't aware of any radiation coming over to Tokyo, basically. But this time, the accident was so big, and it happened just after the earthquake and a tsunami disaster, and damage towards the nuclear power plants was obvious, and we saw the smoke coming out from the reactors. So it came to us with a much bigger impact, I think, this time. So that's why we happened to see quite a lot, and I think learned quite a lot from this.
We'll provide more information from Japan from Tony Boyes and Yuki Mikami at the Talk Nation Radio website. Paul Guntner is a specialist in nuclear reactor hazards and security with the group Beyond Nuclear. He also specializes in organizing and movement building, as well as radiation impacts on health and wildlife. We asked Paul Guntner to comment on the media's coverage to include some of what NPR has been reporting, softening at times the impact of the nuclear radiation leak at Fukushima plant.
You know, all kinds of media are basically in the sway of this industry, but it is particularly egregious to be an apologist for the Tokyo Electric Power Company at this point, or the nuclear industry. Because, you know, now that they're admitting that the radiation releases have arrived at a Chernobyl proportions, remember, these are for leaks to the atmosphere that were occurring weeks ago when they were telling us that there was no immediate health threat. And now they've admitted that the leaks that they, you know, showed no concern or trivialized, as we've heard on NPR countless times, these, in fact, were the same kinds of proclamations that led to pregnant women and children in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, being advised they might want to leave town 3 days after the accident and the radioactive releases occurred on March 28, 1979. This is the same kind of declarations that we heard when a Swedish nuclear engineer at the Forsmark nuclear power plant in Sweden discovered that high radiation readings that they were recording in April 1986 were not coming from their nuclear power plant, but in fact coming from the Chernobyl nuclear power plant thousands of miles away in Ukraine. And the governments in Kiev were, you know, marching the children through the squares on May Day without warning or protection from the radioactive releases that were spilling out of the Chernobyl plant at that time. You know, clearly, time and time again, it's always the same story, that when they lose control of nuclear reactors, the first thing that they look to do is control the information. And this has been, again, dramatically underscored by the admission that these radioactive releases that are now threatening to health were occurring weeks ago when they were telling there was no immediate danger. You know, the disclosure that the tremendous amount of radioactivity that was released into the environment from the Fukushima Daiichi plant that has caused this upgrade to a Class 7 occurred weeks ago, and that the information was not disclosed. These are disclosures now that completely undermine the trust of not only TEPCO, but the entire industry. An accident anywhere is an accident everywhere as far as nuclear power goes.
We went outside to watch the wave rolling in as it took away everything I once knew. We stood helpless and looked at the town that had been Oyasumi Daisuki Minami Sanriku. Oyasumi Daisuki Minami Sanriku.
David Rovix with Song for an Orphan, honoring the orphans of the March 11th earthquake and tsunami in Japan. 13,000 are now known dead, and global impacts continue to be felt. Yet even before March 11th, a battle was shaping up in America between clean energy activists and lobbyists seeking more of the same fabulous state and federal offsets for coal, oil, and nuclear power. It was into this rarefied environment that Connecticut lawmakers introduced Senate Bill 1176, a tax increase on in-state energy. The bill charges 2 cents per kilowatt hour for nuclear power as a tax, and it's based on an estimate of income from Millstone that would be over $300 million annually in taxes for power generated there. Now, Dominion is running an expensive PR campaign to fight the new tax. They took out newspaper ads, held a town meeting to complain about the tax, called customers, and donated to NPR, so that NPR newscasts about the nuclear industry in the U.S., aging power plants here, and Fukushima's disaster end with their thanking Dominion, operating Millstone Power Plant, employing more than 1,000 people in Waterford, Connecticut. It's become a fight over jobs rather than safety, and Connecticut's corporate press has not been mentioning the human errors leading to several expensive accidents at Millstone during 1977 through 1999. The plant was less than 10 years old on June 10, 1977, when a hydrogen gas explosion damaged 3 buildings and forced shutdown. Millstone is the same kind of pressurized water reactor that blew up in Fukushima, Japan. Later on February 20, 1996, a leaking valve forced a shutdown at Units 1 and 2 with multiple equipment failures found. Finally, on May 25, 1999, there was a steam leak in the feed water heater at Millstone, causing a shutdown and damage to the control board. The cost for repairs? Just under the $300 million mark that the state is now asking Millstone to pay annually for operating in Connecticut. Senate Bill 1176 would replace a controversial surcharge on electric customers who have already been asked to pay for nuclear power at the same rates that they pay for natural gas, something lawmakers say is unfair. Residents were up in arms recently over near 50% increases in their electric bills. But the tax is more about providing incentives for new, safer, cleaner forms of energy, according to Dennis Shane, a spokesman for Connecticut's Department of Environmental Protection.
The proposal they're looking at does tax nuclear energy, the Millstone plant. Also, there is a sliding scale that also puts a tax on facilities that use coal and oil. But the bill is aimed at encouraging renewable and clean energy in that the tax is less on natural gas, which does burn cleaner and doesn't create the same types of environmental risks. And then there would be no tax on renewable sources of energy, people who can generate electricity from renewable sources.
The spokesperson for Dominion Resources and Millstone Nuclear Power Plant had told state residents that the company would leave, close Millstone, and leave them without the energy they need. Later, Holt amended his comments by saying the company was also considering layoffs, operating with fewer people, for example, during shutdowns, something we asked Dennis Shane about as to safety.
There are standards for the operation of a plant. They're regulated by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. There's various safety standards, and whatever decisions they make, you know, they'll need to do that in compliance with all applicable, you know, laws and regulations. We have, you know, a role in oversight of the Millstone power plant and environmental monitoring of its operations, but these issues of, you know, the tax package being discussed at the legislature and how Dominion might react to that are not really in the purview of DEP.
We asked the spokesman for Dominion and Millstone, Ken Holt, if he thought the threat to either shut down the plants or operate them with fewer workers posed a health and safety risk.
We wouldn't be operating if we're shut down. I mean, we need a certain number of people to maintain the systems in a safe, stable shutdown condition. And we're evaluating, you know, what those numbers are, what kind of personnel that we would need to do that. That kind of planning is going on right now.
Can you tell me what your biggest complaint is? I mean, let's just say, for example, you pay that $300 million a year. Is Dominion going to go under?
Will Dominion as a company go under? No. Does the $330 million tax make Millstone not economically viable? Yes. Millstone will shut down. It will not generate a single dime of tax revenue because it won't be generating any electricity.
You've got one plant closed and inoperable, too dangerous to run. It's got nuclear waste material sitting on top of it. And
Whoa.
That's true, isn't it?
No. The reason Unit 1 is shut down is the previous owner, Northeast Utilities, decided that it wasn't economically viable. So they made the decision to shut it down in 1998.
At Beyond Nuclear in Maryland, Paul Guntner is familiar with Dominion, based in nearby Virginia. We asked him about their threats to close Millstone in Connecticut or operate with fewer workers.
This industry of chain reaction, in fact, has its own chain where they, you know, each nuclear power plant is promotionally linked with the next. And it's very likely that they are looking at Millstone as yet another weak link in this nuclear fuel chain that binds us all to an ever uncertain future from the threat of nuclear waste and nuclear weapons. The Millstone nuclear complex is, in fact, three reactors, two which are pressurized water reactors, Millstone 2 and 3, but Millstone 1 is a Fukushima-style General Electric boiling water reactor, Mark 1 containment. And they put all their nuclear waste up on the roof of the reactor in a pool. So there's hundreds of tons of nuclear waste sitting in a pool outside of primary containment, just like at Fukushima Daiichi. It's older fuel, it's cooler fuel, but it is outside of containment. And it's a real concern that it doesn't have an emergency power system. The reactor is closed. It's been closed since the 1990s. But the fact is that you do have all this nuclear waste sitting in that rooftop pool that is not only a safety concern, but a very real security concern, particularly in a post-9/11 world. you know, now that we've seen 3/11 and we know quite well about 9/11, the nuclear power industry, we should be abandoning it. You know, obviously what we've seen with Fukushima, with, you know, the Gulf oil spill, and with the coal mining disasters, there is a cost of coal, oil, and nuclear that the people who profit should pay more of in terms of the liabilities to people, to property, to resources, and to the future, you know, even in context of global climate change. So there is a cost of doing business, and that is a cost that these companies should bear and should compete with in context of energy policies that do not pollute, that do not need evacuation zones, that do not emit nuclear waste for which there's no solution at this point, and a cost that somebody will bear down the future for hundreds and thousands of years, long after the last watt of electricity. So we don't feel that Dominion has much leeway in trying to avoid these costs. But at the same time, what you're faced with is clearly sort of a hostage crisis, where you have a large company that's not willing to share the cash cow that it's been milking, despite the fact that it's radioactive.
And what about more hopeful signs for a surge in alternative energy in solar, wind, hydro, and geopower?
There are hopeful signs that the advent of renewable energy is here. We have the Google Corporation, for example, expanding its solar campus for photovoltaic electric power in California. We have Google also investing $5 billion to the first vertebrae of a backbone of high voltage direct current transmission for offshore wind, starting in Virginia and going all the way up the eastern seaboard, eventually to Maine, where the University of Maine at Orno is looking at generating 5 gigawatts of offshore wind 10 to 50 miles in the Gulf of Maine from the just this abundant resource of renewables that's provided for harvesting from the sun and from the wind. It's really a question of political will at this point to just lay the path open for implementation of wind and solar and energy efficiency and conservation. I mean, the markets are behind this now. You will get private financing when, in fact, what we've seen for nuclear power is that it will only be government deficit spending that can push this juggernaut forward.
You've been listening to Sprouts. Paul Guntner of Beyond Nuclear, Tony Boyes and Yuki Mikami in Japan, and Connecticut DEP spokesman Dennis Shane, as well as Ken Holt, spokesman for Dominion and Millstone Nuclear Power in Connecticut. You can find more at our website for talknationradio.org. Special thanks to Daphne Weisham of Earthbeat Radio. Sprouts is a weekly program produced in collaboration with community radio stations and independent producers across the country, bringing you local radio productions of national interest. The program is coordinated and distributed by Pacifica Radio. Thanks to Michael Yoshida at Satellite Operations. If you or someone at your station has a radio production that you wish to rebroadcast on Sprouts to showcase it nationally, contact Air Traffic Controller Ursula Rudenberg, URSULA at pacifica.org. I'm Dory Smith of Talk Nation Radio in Storrs, Connecticut. Thanks for listening, and see you next week on Sprouts.